Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives, blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just 10 bucks. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Sam Melia. Sam, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and an honour.
Yeah, no, well, and we're delighted to have you because your case annoyed me quite a lot when it happened. Probably not as much as it annoyed you. But
kind of frustrated me.
Yes. But nevertheless, it did annoy me quite a lot. We talk about what happened in your case, and you've actually written a book about it, Legal, Truth or Guilty. Which covers it. And I'll just sort of cite one of the opening pages of that, where you've got an excerpt from the case, and it was stickers within the law in isolation range from more or less mainstream quotes about freedom or speech or anti-abortion to generally what would be regarded as extreme but lawful political opinions. And the prosecution apparently said, it does not matter whether the contents of the stickers is true or not. And this is the extraordinary bit, because truth is no defence in court.
Yeah, pretty staggering, especially that, when we heard it for the first time in court.
That blew my mind that you can... So, I mean, explain to the audience what you did, but as we've already established, as far as the court was concerned, everything you did was legal and everything you did was truthful, but they convicted you anyway.
Yeah, so I was the head of a project called the 100 Handers, which was basically stickers. And I released them anonymously online, and each one was curated by myself and numbered so that it had like a hard copy to refer back to in case they were changed by anyone. And that did really well for about 5-6 years, between 2015 to 2020. And like I say, they were curated by myself, and the intention was always to stay within the kind of woolly free speech laws we have in this country.
But I walk into Swindon and the lower part of town especially is just covered with stickers. There's stickers everywhere.
Yeah, so that's why I thought when I designed it, it's like, well, that seems like a legitimate form of expression because you've got Communist Party posters all over Leeds. And it's like, so if they're getting away with it and it's got, you know, the actual party, the address and everything there, so it'd be easy to enforce if they were illegal. I thought, I guess stickers are fine. Yeah. We can get away with
it. I mean, if they're getting stuck on a nice building in the Cotswolds, I think I'd be annoyed. But if they're just going over a communist sticker, fair game, really.
Because the state seems to decide it's fine. On the back of the book, I've got a photo where it's like, I think it's some communist meeting, Marxism or something like that. And over the top, I've got a sticker saying, like, you know, demographics. I think, what was it, 1966? We won the World Cup 2066. We're going to be a minority in our own country. So it's like these stickers were going up where stickers normally go up.
So what kind of thing were on these stickers?
Well, by the end of it, there was 300 plus, and they ran the gamut of almost any political topic you can think of, because I took suggestions from people. Because we thought we were going to be defending the nature of the stickers in regard to this charge of distribution of racially material meant to incite racial hatred. We thought it's like, okay, well, let's see how many of the stickers actually refer to race. And we found it was 1 in 10. There's about 13% of them actually made any reference to race. And that includes diversity, multiculturalism, like even kind of more obtuse references. So we thought it's like, well, I mean, clearly the project wasn't set up entirely to incite racial hatred. Because it's like I'm talking about free speech, anti-abortion. I mean, there were stickers that was just like lift weights. stop watching porn. You know, right. It's like, you know, just stuff where it's just throwaway things.
But I mean, presumably even the ones that were mentioning race, I mean, it wasn't like, for example, kill all nons. It wasn't anything like that. It was just White Lives Matter, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like the ones the police highlighted, they picked like 14 of them that they felt were the most egregious, with things like Labour loves Muslim rape gangs. Right. And I mean,
they evidently do.
Yeah. And that was right after, I think, Naz Shah had retweeted that, yes. that post saying white girls need to shut up for the sake of diversity.
Yes.
So it was kind of like, you know, self-evident. And then, I mean, there were other ones I had that said, beware, rape gangs operate in this area, which you would think would be a public good. You know, if these things are proven to be in a place, the police are proven to be...
Well, it is a public good. It's not a state good, because they've been trying to cover it up for 40, 50 years.
Yes.
So
there
is that.
And that's what we see, is the state appears so fragile that it's like one guy making stickers that kind of poke holes in the lie of multiculturalism is the biggest threat to them.
And am I right in thinking that you had actually sort of walked away from this project by the time the police got involved?
Yeah, I'd kind of sunsetted it late 2020, because... at the time when I'd started it, there wasn't really any political vehicle or any activist vehicle that I felt fit me. When Mark Collett started Patriotic Alternative in late 2019, I signed up for that. I became the Yorkshire regional organiser. And then by late 2020, I was thinking of stickers and being like, I'm basically just rewording one I've done 3 years prior. And I was like, doesn't really need to do anymore. You know, we're out there doing banner drops, demos, all this kind of stuff. So it's like, I'll just let it lie. It was 6 months after that the arrest came, when I was on my way to work. So I was really surprised, because I thought, it's like, oh, this is going to be related to the demonstration we just did, or the banner drop over the M62 or something like that.
But no, it was about stickers from years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And right. And when they arrested me as well, they said, they had three charges: possession of terrorist material, international financial fraud, or something to do with like financial funding of terrorism, and the distribution of material. And I thought, it's like,
so two terrorism charges and a sticker
thing. Yeah
I mean, they almost certainly did tagged on the terror bits, just because it gives them a vast amount more powers to investigate you, including going into your bank.
Well,
but presumably that didn't hold up at all.
No, they dropped that as soon as we got into questioning. Like, they began
on day one.
Yeah, day one. As soon as they held me in a cell,
first conversation,
a few hours, took me into the questioning room, and they started going down the terrorism through. And an officer knocked on the door, came in, went, "We're actually going to cut those two. So don't worry about them. It's just the
we were just using that as a tactic to dig up dirt on you. Yeah, but we had no intention of ever doing it.
Well, so. Also to get the warrant, because they've got to go to a magistrate and justify why they're going to arrest this guy, raid his house, take every device in his house, and
literally the first hour of speaking to you, it turns out that the whole justification for the digging into you was bullshit.
Mm. But it's counter-terrorism who was leading the investigation. So presumably without any actual terrorism, they couldn't have justified it. You know, because I was done under a public order offence.
It makes you wonder how many fewer people would be stabbed to death, blown up, and the rest of it, if counter-terrorism police was actually focusing on terrorism.
Yeah.
Rather than providing cover for political hits on people we just don't agree with.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, with all these terror attacks, they're always like, oh, they're known to authorities and stuff like that.
Yeah, but we were busy doing some other bullshit.
Rather than me or, you know, your grandma posting on Facebook or something like that.
Yeah.
I always imagine it like, do you remember that film, The Other Guys, where they have like The Rock and someone else who are like the police tag team duo, but they're doing all the really cool cases.
Right.
And then there's Mark Wahlberg and Will Farrell, who are like chasing up parking tickets.
I imagine
the counterterrorism officers dealing with my case were in the corner dealing with some stickers while like some of
the trainees and
diffusing
and
a bomb at like seven seconds left and everything, like, you know. But
was the real sin being, because you mentioned Patriotic Alternative, and I think your wife's quite heavily involved with that.
She's the deputy leader. Yeah.
Okay, that's not actually an organisation I know an awful lot about. I know it's kind of out there, but I'm not really up to speed with what they're. But what is it? Because it's probably that, isn't it, that made them want to go after you, do you think?
No, I mean, the stickers, the investigation for the stickers began back in just after PA had started, but they didn't know who I was at the time, so they wouldn't have known I was associated with Patriotic Alternative. I think the stickers were making a stink because you had politicians talking about them. You know, they had the news stories with the local councillor kind of standing next to a sticker on a bin looking disappointed with it. and obviously we had the summer of BLM.
Right.
And White Lives Matter stickers were going up all over the place as well. So I think they were raising the backs of a lot of people who were just kind of like,
"Is PA had ambitions to become a political party, but has basically just been stopped at every turn.
Is that right? We looked at it initially because some people involved wanted to be a political party. Mark and Laura have never thought that the political route would be viable, especially for like...
It was mainly a pressure group then.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And community building as well. Like, that's been the biggest thing. Obviously, Mark was involved with the BNP and he said it's like you'd have people come and go based on the election cycle. You know, you do well, you get people in, you have a bad turn, everyone leaves. And it's like he wanted something that persisted throughout. And and that's turned out great. Obviously, I met my wife through PA.
Yes.
And then we've had a bunch of people meet their partners, have kids.
Right.
And I've got some lifelong friends who I've met through it as well.
So you don't think it was that connection that made the state want to go after you then?
No, I think that was a happy coincidence once they found out who I was. They were like, oh, great. You know, two birds, one stone and kind of thing. But no, when they began looking for who the head of the 100 Anders was, they had no idea.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
it probably was as little as a councillor looking disappointed while pointing at it, saying, well, yeah. I found an opinion that I don't agree with, and therefore, you know, the police must do something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And it's one of these things where it's like the slightest bit of dissent to the kind of multicultural system just triggers that immune response from them, where it's like, we've got to shut it down no matter the cost.
Yes. So you find yourself arrested and dragged in, and then they immediately drop these terrorism charges, just evidencing that was complete bullshit all along. What kind of happened from that point?
It was a lot of questioning over basically establishing the facts that I was the head of the 100 Anders, which at the time I was dead to rights on. You know, they'd raided the house and my desk is covered in kind of like half designed stickers and the printer's there and they've got my computer, which has all the mass copies on and everything. So it's like, I was never denying it.
Big counter-terrorism win. We burst in. Is there a bomb? No, there's no stickers.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, chances are they were hoping for something really inflammatory there, but you know, no weapon, nothing like that.
Yes, exactly, a bomb.
But nothing like that appeared. So no commented through, I think, about 4 hours of questioning. They can do two at a time.
Okay.
The end of the second hour of questioning.
Did you get a lawyer for this?
I got the you know, the state appointed, just like
were they guy. Absolutely shit hot? Were they all over?
He
it?
Was pretty good, but he was just like, just no comment it, because really they ain't got anything here.
Okay,
you know. So, but at the end of the first session of questioning, they raised that we just found out a few weeks prior that Laura was pregnant, my wife,
so they raised that.
Yeah, they raised it. It's like, oh, I don't know if you know, but Laura's pregnant, and you know, with these charges, you're looking at 10 years. So, you know, have a think about that. And they shoved me back in the cell.
So
to ruminate. They were clearly hoping
there to break the news to you that she was pregnant to cause you psychological
panic and
distress.
Go, like, I'll say anything. Just You know, what do you need? Do you need me to roll
what
on people?
Scummy tactics.
I know. Yeah, but thankfully Laura had been calling the station, and they put her through to the cell intercom. And she basically told me to, in no uncertain terms, don't tell them anything and F them. So I was kind of like, all right, cool, I've got her backing. And once I spoke to my duty sister again, he was like, no, it's not 10 years. It's like you're looking at maximum 3 to 5. You know, and
I mean,
that's...
Christ, even 3 to 5 years for
but
some
that's
stickers.
Assuming they'd have a crime that they could point to as like, your stickers incited this. You know, which would allow them to step up the sentencing. As it was, they couldn't cite a single crime that had been incited for these stickers that were meant to incite. So, and we were able to prove that in court as well. Like, we got the counter-terrorism sergeant up in the stand and said, have any crimes actually been incited? Considering I've been doing this for 6 years.
Yes.
And this was apparently my intent.
And there was a year's gap between you finishing it?
About six months, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if there was a crime... I mean, they would have found it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, they'd catalogued and mapped every single appearance of the sticker that they could.
Good Lord.
We went through that in court for about a day and a half. It's like here in Dorset on a bin is a sticker. It says this. You know, here in Walsall, there's a sticker.
But you didn't actually put up any of these stickers. These were just...
They couldn't prove that I'd put up a single sticker. So they tacked on an additional charge of encouraging racially aggravated criminal damage. Which my solicitor said, don't worry about that, because first of all, they've got to prove that your biodegradable stickers are criminal damage, which there's no precedent for that. No one's ever been charged for criminal damage for stickers, so there's no way they're going to get it. But the jury went guilty on that as well.
But I mean, there were counter examples here. So that guy who stood up at, was it Glastonbury, and came out with some really sort of anti-white stuff, you know, that was just passed. You had that Labour councillor who attended a rally and in front of thousands of people said, you know, slit their throats in reference to, I believe that was in reference to white people.
I think he said the far right or some.
So you can stand up in a crowd of people and tell them to slit people's throats. But if you put a sticker out that says, you know, the site's government statistics saying that the demographic change is taking place, that warrants counter-terrorism police being pulled off something that might actually save a life and directed to going after a purely ideological enemy where they can't even demonstrate that a single crime has been inspired by a sticker.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. But that's the luck of the draw with the juries as well, you know. There were three people who were clearly foreign. There was a Pakistani gentleman. I think one guy was Egyptian. One guy was some fresh off the boat African, still with a heavy African accent. Mm. And then the rest of the jury was like nine white people. However,
I mean, that's probably worse because, I mean, if my taxi rides are anything to go by, the average foreigner is more likely to be aware of what's going on than many of the white people who are just completely deluded on this stuff.
Yeah, and once the prosecution's kind of bandying about, you know, the term racist, it's like, well, that just like, it's like MK Ultra for white people where they go, racist, bad person, guilty. Yes. You know, and it's like, you know, completely disregarded. It's like, we opened this case by saying the stickers were lawful and saying that it's like, just don't worry if they're true, it doesn't matter. And it's like, and still we're coming away with a guilty verdict. And we really thought the jury was kind of going to go down a 50-50 line, similar to kind of like a Brexit vote or something.
I mean, how did you feel your case went? Because, I mean, it feels like to me you'd have a strong case that you hadn't done anything illegal and you hadn't said anything that was untrue. I mean, why was that not a slam dunk for your barrister?
It should have been. And it felt like it was, because at points they played two excerpts from podcasts that I'd done as the head of the 100 Handers, where I'm on there saying these stickers are within the law, I have no intention to incite racial hatred, all this kind of stuff. And even within the sticker zip file itself, it had the rules and it was like, don't place these anywhere where they might be considered intimidatory or anything like that. And they had all my private messages from the last 5 or 6 years where I'm explicitly telling friends and compatriots, like people I've no reason to lie to, that it's like, yeah, this is, I've designed them all to stay within the law and, you know, don't want to break our laws or anything like that. So it seemed like this, it would have been a slam dunk. And then my barrister's closing statement, fantastic, where it's basically, it's like, we've agreed that these are legal. This all comes down to whether you think someone has a right to talk about these topics. And clearly the jury didn't feel like it. I mean, at one point the jury came back in to ask a question of the judge. And they asked, it's like, are we just taking the 14 stickers the police have highlighted or all 300 plus in a few different languages? And I thought, it's like, well, if they're asking to take all of them into account, surely that would be on my side, because the 90% of them aren't even relating to race. And there was a guy...
Is that heavily what they leaned on, the racism? Is that what they were...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're effectively convicted for racism, for not going along with multiculturalism?
Yeah, yeah, because they operate on this kind of circular logic where it's like, right, if you talk about these things, then you must be right-wing. However, if you're right-wing, you're a racist, therefore you're not allowed to talk about these things, which serves their thing, because it's like, well, the only way to get out of that is just don't talk about it, which is, for the most part, what everyone does.
It's like the witch trials, where they float in the river, and if you sink and drown, then you're innocent, and if you float, you need to be burnt.
Yeah, and it's like, we're going to put you on trial for being a racist, and turns out you talked about rape gangs, so, you know, open and shut case.
I mean, talking about the medieval comparison, I mean, that's one of the things that occurred to me when first looking at your case, is that in this country, in common law, in around the 12th century, we had the revolution of bringing in mens rea, guilty minds. But it was always linked to actus rea. And the reason that we did that is because before then, crimes are strict liability. So if you, for example, if you were attacked by a brigand and you killed the brigand in self-defense, well, that's murder. And they don't take it into account. So mens rea was introduced to say, okay, well, was there an intent of a crime here? Was it just self-defense or anything like that? And anything applied with that? And here we are about 1,000 years later, and they've just decided... okay, well, if you haven't got an actus rea, well, that's not a problem. That's barely an inconvenience. Yeah. We can get him on the second part, which is the mens rea. That is a complete inversion of the entirety of English law and just natural justice, that you can say, okay, well, no crime has been committed, but we think that there might have been a guilty motive, and therefore that alone, it's maddening.
Yeah, it's insane. And then just the idea that I could be doing this for 6 years,
yes,
and that it's like it could have, a crime could have been committed in the future, and it's like, I mean, am I either completely incompetent at inciting racial hatred, or maybe that was just never my intention. You know? And it's like, but instead they've gone, it's like, no, he really wanted to. Yeah. But after, I mean, I was putting out stickers. Believe me, if I wanted to, you know, really put some inflammatory stuff on them, it would have been very easy, you know? So it's like the fact that I wasn't, the fact that I'd explicitly said in private messages and through my releases and everything that I wasn't intending to, should have been enough. But it really was, like, we were going into the trial thinking we were going to be defending the content of the stickers, and immediately became clear, oh no, we're going to be defending just my mentality of as someone ostensibly right wing. It's like, can that person engage within legal speech? And apparently not.
Essentially you're defending, is it legal to be right wing?
Yeah, that's what
is it legal to hold certain thoughts?
And that's the thing, they're quite comfortable with you holding those thoughts. However, if you act on them, if you put them out there, if you speak about them, you know, publish them.
Well, that's us, because that's what we do all day.
Well, yeah, but it's like things have changed so much since going away. I mean, I was arguing in court that the rape gangs even existed. And the prosecution was being, it's like, no, you're merely making these up to basically suit your own racist beliefs.
Okay.
But
now it's a mainstream talking point.
Exactly. And by the time I'd been released from prison, you know, you had survivors on Newsnight saying, yes, they do exist, and they're predominantly Pakistani males. Okay. And the state saying, yeah, we've always known they existed. And we're definitely going to do something about it now. Obviously, they haven't.
Yeah, we're going to do an inquiry in 2029 when Labour leaves government.
It's scheduled
to begin after they leave government. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only historical comparison I could found to this after the introduction of mens rea was, I think there was a 1351 law that made it illegal to imagine the death of the king. And so, yeah.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. So they introduced mens rea, and then they thought, well, actually, for this one exception, 1351, if you imagine the death of the king, that's an instant execution effect. And as a result, for hundreds of years, the reigning monarch never attended a funeral, because if you were at a funeral and you saw the king, you might briefly imagine the king being dead.
Mass arrest.
And then you have to basically wipe out the entire congregation.
That's insane.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And you laugh about it now, right? Because it clearly is insane.
Mm.
And so I presumably, you know, Charles can attend a funeral now if he wants to. But that is the only parallel that I could find in the entire legal system of this, which is, okay, we're going to criminalize somebody simply on what they think. Mm. And it's clearly absurd. And yet we got to that point where a crime is no longer required, just simply a thought.
Yeah, yeah. And clearly they feel confident enough to take it to court. They didn't look confident. I mean, I was taking a look at the counter-terror officers and everything when they arrived, and they looked positively ill. And when we had him up in the dock answering questions, he was all pallid, quiet, like just for, and quite clearly they didn't think they had a strong case. However, they must have just got lucky with that jury. You know, you don't know if someone's got a black wife or mixed kids or whatever, and it's like, and they feel, you know, a white person being racist is the worst thing in the world. But I mean, even the judge, when he advised the jury when they're about to leave, he did that, you know, that Voltaire quote or whatever, saying, you know, you might not agree with what he says, but you defend the death, his right to say it. And I thought, it's like, even the judge seems kind of tacitly on side here. And it's like, I don't see how anyone could find me guilty. But then it's like, how many white people are equipped to argue with a non-white about a white person's right to freedom of speech?
And I mean, it clearly is a massive one-directional bias, because, you know, the example of that Labour councillor who said, you know, slit their throat, as an example. And then I tried searching for cases that had gone the other way. And I did find one. There was a British guy, black British guy by the name, I think he went by Michael X, a bit of a parody on Malcolm X. And he attended a meeting that said, you know, white people are monkeys who have no souls and should be killed. And he was arrested for incitement, which is the closest comparison that I could find, and jailed. That was in 1967.
Really?
So, and that was the last time that it has gone the other way. Since then, it has purely been white people resisting demographic change that have been jailed or attacked in this way.
Yeah, yeah, and it will be, you know, because it's like that's really what the system at the time, 67, it's like, yeah, they were still operating on under the auspices of it's like, yeah, they're coming in, but it's like, it's going to be fine. We're all going to be equal and everything like that. Mm. And we'll enforce the law the same across the board.
Yeah, and that's like, out the window entirely.
Oh, yeah. And like you saw with that counsellor, who, you know, motioned to slit his throat and everything like that. And it's like, well, you know, he's got a jury of his peers, you know, and they're all going to go. It's like, no, we're not sending down one of our own. And really, it's this whole multicultural thing just makes a mockery of jurisprudence, because it's like everyone's looking out for themselves except white people.
Yeah. I mean, that is a problem. And I was reading a thread on Twitter last night about an absolutely grievous case. It was a black murderer, and they had him on video murdering somebody. He walked. And then there was people sharing other experiences in sort of quote tweets and so on. And this one guy was saying, yeah, I was on a New York jury. And it was a case for a rapist, and they found his DNA in multiple women. They found overwhelming evidence, and when he was on the in the collaborations with the rest of the jury members, I think like 7 of the 12 were black, and they said there's too many black people in. Yeah, they admitted that he was guilty, but their argument was there's too many black men in jail, and therefore they're not going to convict him. So you can't have a jury system in a multiracial society unless everybody in it is signed up to the idea of justice. But that doesn't seem to cross racial lines.
No, not at all. I think every other racial group has very strong in-group preference for their own, and that extends as far as...
Well, that probably explains why they're so paranoid about cases like yours, because if the white majority ever, well, while we're still a majority at least, if the white population were to ever adopt the same mentality, I mean, the whole thing just falls apart. And in fact, I mean, Dominic Cummings keeps talking about this on his Substack. You know, he says that, you know, publicly they're denying that there is two-tier justice, but within the state itself, they're perfectly well aware that there is two-tier justice, and they're all in absolute panic because they can't admit they made a mistake. They can't unwind it. Their whole power structure rests on this ideology. But they know that they're pushing water uphill, because the reality is that there is two-tier justice, and they have no idea what to do because they can't get out of it.
Well, I think that's partly why they want to do away with these kind of jury trials, is so that they can have a magistrate who's going to be supposedly more objective to deal with these things, and they can avoid the embarrassment of, you know, some, you know, London councillor literally wishing death on people, getting away with it, and then some guy putting out legal stickers and going down for 2 years. It's this thing where they're so far along this path now where they can't go back. It's kind of like a trans who's like, they've locked bits off or all this kind of stuff, and then it's like it's they're bought in at that point. It's this or death.
There's no growing back the bits at this point.
No. And I feel like the establishment feels that way about this kind of multicultural experiment, you know, and it's been referred to as such by Starmer in that speech, at least where it's like, this is an experiment that's not going well. And
then they always unwind it afterwards because the logic of the system explains that you can't back down on any of this stuff because it undermines our entire power structure the moment you do.
And it's existential for them. It's like when you think of the level of the crimes and some of the abhorrent things that have happened to us as a result of this experiment, the retribution to kind of really bring justice to it would be very, very harsh. So it's like they've got to kind of just head down, tunnel through, and hopefully come out the other side into the utopia. However,
I have imagined what that world will look like on one or two occasions, but probably best not go there. So describe the moment where, you know, you've got the prosecution presenting a weak case, and the counterterrorism police are looking positively ill. Mm. Describe the moment of the verdict and what happened following that.
Well, we got called back in, and the jury came back with the unanimous guilty on both, and we were just gobsmacked because we thought we presented such a good case, so much the prosecution's evidence seemed to be counterintuitive to serve us. Like I say, playing podcasts and, you know, displaying private messages and things like that. And I was like, all these things seem to serve our side. I don't understand why you've put this in the prosecution case. So we were really surprised with that, and we went away, and it was a month between that and sentencing, and thankfully I was bailed for that. I didn't have to be in remand.
I mean, very, very quickly on the jury stuff, I've done jury service a couple of times now, and I'll tell you, if my experience is anything to go through, of the 12, maybe 3 or 4 actually have an opinion one way or the other.
Mm.
And all the rest of them are just like, why am I having to do this? I want to go home. I want to get back to my job.
And on top of that, you're not playing jury on a rape case. It's a guy who put out stickers.
Yeah, so I mean, in my case, it was actually a stabbing. But
yeah, so some serious. Yes. So it's like, even with that, you've got 3 or 4 people who actually care, and the rest could go either way.
And basically, as soon as those 3 or 4 had indicated which way they were leaning, almost all the rest were like, okay, we're going that way because whatever, just get me out of here. I want to go home.
Yeah. And it was a tedious trial because it was done under the terrorism protocol, which means that you can't just skip over any evidence. You have to run through everything. So it was a really droll trial, like just going through absolute minutiae. But there was a guy on the jury who I nicknamed Shitlib because he just had the physiognomy and archetypal
look.
You
can tell.
Yeah. And it's like from the moment he saw me, he looked like he hated me. And then it's like as the trial went on, just more and more just dirty looks my way. And I was like, this guy absolutely hates my guts. To the point where I was like, I swear I've worked with this guy before. And I ended up calling like a place I'd worked. And it's like, was Thingy in last week? And they were like, oh, yeah. And I was like, all right, it's just a look some people have, I guess. But he looked a dead ringer for him. And it's like he seemed really pleased with himself when I got that guilty verdict. And I thought it's like, you know, like you say, if the majority of them don't care, and then there's, you know,
a few that do, it swings it. Yeah.
So,
one of the interesting things in the book is because you weren't expecting the verdict, you didn't have any shoes with you apart from your fancy court shoes. And then you got taken to jail in fancy court shoes.
Some very nice brown boots, yeah. Because we had the pre-sentence report and went through them and everything. Because I had a job, young kids, another child on the way, they were like, prison isn't going to serve him. It's not going to change his mind or anything, so there's no reason to send him there.
Apart from spite.
And we recommend community service, you know, 5,000 hours, digging holes or whatever.
And was that the judge's call to go against that?
Yes. Yeah. So when the judge arrived, he seemed like a completely different man from when we'd actually had the trial.
He had probably got a phone call.
Yeah. I think that's probably the most likely. And he cited, I think some Palestinian protesters had been like putting death threats on MPs around that time. It was when the big London protests were going on. And he said, because some of my stickers were, you know, anti-Zionist. He said, we need to make an example of political activists and that they can't get away with this kind of stuff. So I'll be recommending 2 years. And like I say, I'd packed a bag, but considering the pre-sentence report had said, don't send prison, judge seemed tacitly on our side during the trial, I thought, like, it's going to be a suspended sentence. So, you know, two of everything, completely forgot a change of shoes. And then when he went guilty, I was just completely spiraling. I was like, miss birth of my child first year. My daughter Catherine at the time was 2 years old, so it's like a really kind of important time when they're developing and everything's new. And I was just completely flabbergasted.
I mean, that's awful, but I mean, just quickly on the judge's statement there, that is a really dangerous sentiment. We can't allow this process to be carried out in the political sphere.
Mm.
So where do you want it carried out then?
Well, that's the thing.
Because if it's not done peacefully and politically, are you sure that you want to go down that route?
But what other tool does the state have? Because they can't actually address these concerns. So they only have kind of the hammer, and they just hit everything with the hammer.
Yes.
And it's like dealing with the people who were sent to kind of realign my mindset, they didn't have any arguments. It was like, I mean, that's all true, and that is happening. However, if you don't care about it, everything seems great. And it's like, okay, but I do care about the rape of 12-year-olds.
Well, a lot of people don't care until it comes home to them in some way or another.
Yeah, but even then, I mean, you have, like, the fathers of the, like, murdered girls who kind of come out and then be like, I love burritos or whatever, and it's like, Mexican killed your daughter, man. It's like, maybe show a bit of remorse. At the very least.
I don't think our ancestors would have responded in this way.
No. I think there'd be very different courses.
But then I suppose that's why they had a country and we don't, which is probably what it comes down to. So
You then get, what do you get then, taken straight off to jail?
Yeah, you go downstairs, you check in all your gear, and they lock you in a cell until there's a van, or there's enough people to fill up a van. And I went off to Armley Jail, which is something I've driven past a thousand times living in Leeds. Yeah. And I was like, wow, I'm actually going into it. And it's an old Victorian jail with it's nicknamed the Castle, because it's got this big castle facade and everything looks really...
So at least you got to admire the architecture.
Yeah. I was like, I've never been this close before. I'm going through the gate. you're in there with just so many people with mental illness. And being a remand jail, it's like everyone's in there. So murderers, rapists, along with like your low-level drug dealers, people who are in there for putting up stickers. You know, it's a real mixed bag.
Yeah, so what was that experience like? Because, I mean, you know, you're a reasonably big lad. I'm sure you can take care of yourself. But crazy people operate on an entirely different set of logic altogether. So, I mean, what's it like going into one of these places where it's like, oh, bloody hell, these people are just, they're not in control of their own mind?
It's very scary. Right. And then you begin to realize that it's like most people don't want trouble. However, like you say, there are the ones who are mentally unstable and you're trying to steer clear of them as much as possible. But every so often you just get put in with them. And I mean, my first night and for the first few days, I was in with this guy who's a spice head. And it's like...
What is a spice head?
So a spice is a synthetic cannabinoid. Which it gets into prison because it's very easy to hide, because basically it's a liquid, but if you soak paper in it and then dry it out, you can then smoke the paper and get the same effect. So, and I had no idea what spice was, but it's like it seemed to produce this kind of like, you're either very erratic or you're a zombie. And it's like it comes swings. He'd be both at different times. So it's like you're on the top bunk trying to read a book while this guy's like pacing the cell and like just muttering to himself. And you're like, God. And then it's like the next minute, you'd just be like, like that. And you're like, you okay? Are you dead? What's going on? And then, you know, there was another time I shared a cell with a guy who was, I can't remember what drug it was, but he crushed it up on the table and snorted it. And
could have been anything really.
He was he was a real jailhead. He'd been in for 10 years, been released on bail, and immediately started dealing drugs and jumped out of a window when the police had raided his house, and now he was back in jail. But it's like he just loved jail, and he was like the wing dealer, but he was just loving life, and he was just up and down all the time. And he had some girlfriend who I think was cheating on him, because he'd be on the phone with her all the time screaming at her and everything. And you just like, I'm at the back of this cell thinking it's like, it's between me and the door if something goes south. And this guy is like, he's been doing 10 years of just prison workout. So he's just absolutely henched out. And I'm just like, oh, this is a tight quarters to fight in if this goes south. There's a lot. And what's it? There was a guy who like Joker smiled himself.
Himself.
Yeah. But it's like he was covered in scars, and he had Joker smiled himself, but not allowed it to heal. So he had this like really broad smile and just looked absolutely terrifying. And he was just always arguing with the officers and everything. And he eventually got moved off the wing, but I was tasked with cleaning his cell, and there was just blood all up the walls, on the ceiling and everything like that. And I was like, Jesus. But there are a lot of those people who are mentally ill, and their only outlet was basically self-harm. So it's like a lot of people cutting up. I think at one point, some guy set the cell next to me on fire while he was inside it. So there's that kind of scary element. But there's just a low level of violence, which you don't normally see much of. And it's not like American prisons where people are getting raped left, right, and center and shivved and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
It's much more based on kind of drug debts. And vape debts as well.
They're just punching and kicking.
Maybe. Yeah, so you'd see people walking around with black eyes and everything. And if there was violence, it wasn't usually done out in the wing. It was basically done quietly in someone's cell. You know, they'd get followed in there and beat the hell out of them. And then they'd come out and, you know, what do you mean, Gov? Nothing happened.
Has your experience of jail sort of led you to think, well, there was a better way of doing this? Because it's starting to sound like, to me, that closing down the asylums was probably a bad idea.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. it's like now we've got all the asylum people stuck in there with a bunch of criminals who have no problem exploiting them, taunting them, just making their lives living hell. There was one lad clearly had just a heavy autism, and prison couldn't possibly be a worse environment for him. But it's... they just all get shoved in together. And so many of these people just need sectioning off and, I don't know, a calm environment at the very least, not in there with some of the most boisterous, loud kind of people imaginable.
But for whatever reason, we decided asylums are bad.
Mm.
But we're still going to lock people up. We're just going to do it in prison, but that sounds nice.
And we'll lock them up for short periods, release them into the public for them to do something, then lock them back up again. And it's pretty crazy. But yeah.
What about the staff? How were they?
The staff were good. For the most part, I think the only criticism I have of the staff is possibly they're too relaxed. They allow a lot to go on under their noses, basically to keep the boat sailing smoothly. So there's the hard power of the officers, and then there's the soft power of basically like the wing dealers who run the drug trade.
So they allow a certain amount of emergent order to manifest.
Yeah, and they'll only start cracking down on drugs if a lot of people start overdosing or there's a lot of violence related to it, like power plays to try and, you know, establish a new leader or anything like that. Then they'll crack down on it. But otherwise, the drugs are kind of being pretty openly dealt with. It's pretty clear who's dealing because you got people coming to people's doors constantly and whispering through the cracks and everything like that. So you can tell immediately, you know, like me as a complete newbie is going like, that guy's clearly dealing. They're on drugs, you know, and everything. But they don't do anything about it because it's like, as long as the wing's running smoothly and there's not too much violence, then we're doing our jobs. Which, I mean, to be fair to them, I don't think you're ever going to stamp it out completely. So it's probably you do have to.
Well, not unless you're willing to use a lot more force,
Yeah.
But it's not like Shawshank Redemption where it's like zero tolerance of everything. Is actually
No. I spoke to a few of the really old guys who've been in and out of prison for decades, and they were saying it's like this prison used to run properly. You know what I mean? We'd be cleaning the floor with a toothbrush, and if an officer walked by, you would stand up, salute, and, you know, call him by the name. It's like, here, calling officers by the first name. Disgusting. Yeah. It's like, you know.
The Monty Python sketch of the guy in the Roman dungeon.
Yeah.
Marvellous people, the Romans.
Yeah. But the officers were relatively good at the job. And I think once a few of them found out what I was in for, and they would they'd talk to me about it, and I'd find a lot of them had kind of political sympathies, but obviously they can't express them because of the jobs. But I became friendly with a lot of them as well because they appreciated someone who wasn't either on spice or attempting to attack them. You know,
So what proportion of people would you say were either on drugs or mental or both? I mean, how many people would you say were in there are actually compos mentis, just criminals?
I mean, you might be looking about 50-50.
Okay.
You know? Probably about 50-50. But then a lot of people, it's like they just knew how to handle the drugs. Like, you'd have people who would be doing spice 10 minutes before they came down the canteen, and they'd be falling over in the queue. And it's kind of like, you know, lunch is at 12. Why would you get high 10 minutes beforehand? But you'd have a lot of guys who seem compos mentis, and then it's like you'd find out, it's like, oh, yeah, I smoke weed in my cell on a night. And it's like, oh, right, okay. So you just quietly do it to yourself.
Okay.
Drugs are rife.
What was the ethnic makeup inside a jail like?
Leeds was pretty mixed bag. A lot of Albanians. The Asian contingent was growing on my wing while I was there.
What do you mean by Asian? Lots of Japanese or something?
Yeah, huge Japanese. Yakuza, huge. they're basically Pakistani.
Right, okay.
I'm still in that old mindset where it's like, well, we can't say the race. I've
seen like actual Asian people now saying we want the term Oriental back.
Yeah.
Because we're fed up of being lumped in with Pakistanis.
Americans get confused, don't they? It's like, there's a big Chinese rape gang problem in Britain. Yes. It's like, no. The Pakistani contingent was growing on my wing. And I don't know if that's why they moved me from Leeds, because of the risk of harm to myself and obviously the bad PR.
Did you interact with the nuns a lot?
A little bit. We'd talk about, because obviously this was post-October 7th, so we'd be talking about the Palestine-Israel issue with them. They're really the only people who cared about it.
I suppose across 300 stickers, you can probably find a touch button issue for pretty much everyone.
Yeah, that was one of the benefits was whoever I spoke to, if I got a feel for what they cared about, I'd be like, oh, I can talk about this.
Did you get anyone in there who was like, oh no, you're a racist, I hate you too? Or is that just the people on juries?
I think I had that conversation two or three times with non-whites, and I basically explained to them that it's like, listen, You know, this is our homeland, and we've been disenfranchised by the state, and we're being replaced, and we oppose that. And when I translate that to their country of origin, whether it's Nigeria or Pakistan or whatever, it's like, well, can you imagine this was happening? We wouldn't allow it. And I was like, okay.
Yeah, they get it.
Imagine you were being arrested if you tried to stop it. Well, what would you do? It's not what would kick off. And it's like,
yeah,
right. And it's like, but you wouldn't agree with being replaced by a different people. No, no, no. It's like,
but then again, right. That's why they have homogeneous countries, because they wouldn't tolerate it. There's something special about the white population that makes them incredibly tolerant to being replaced for some reason.
The powers that be don't have any interest in replacing Nigerians in Nigeria either. It's like, it's got to be European.
Yeah, if I got offered a boat into Nigeria, I'd be like, nah, I'm all right.
Yeah, let alone a dinghy.
Yes.
Stuffed with 70 other Englishmen.
So what about the sort of the compass criminal sort of group? I mean, presumably there's people in there for like murders and stuff, and then they find out that you're there for a sticker.
Yeah, that invited a lot of suspicion that I might be some sort of Fed who had been planted in prison to undercover or something because like that.
Yeah, but surely if you were, you would make up a better, less laughable example than that.
Yeah. But thankfully, prison contraband phones are quite common as well. So they're able to Google my name and they'd be like, oh, no, he is actually in the stickers. That's crazy.
So I take it there wasn't a lot of political prisoners there, because otherwise they would have encountered it before.
No, almost none. It wasn't until probably the back end when it was after the Southport attack and the unrest that we saw around the country.
So were you in for that when that period happened?
Yeah, I remember.
So you got a whole bunch of political prisoners coming in after that?
Yeah, so I was in Hull prison at the time, and obviously I think the Hull unrest had got a bit out of hand, and I met quite a lot of people coming in through that, and that kind of ran the gamut to where there was just like the homeless crackhead who had seen it kicking off and put a bench through a Greg's window just for the fun of it. And he'd be like, all right, nice one, idiot.
Yes.
To like the family man who's, you know, got three kids. This is the first time he's come out for any sort of political activity. Right. And he's in there shouting at a police officer.
You actually met people like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because at PA, we did the political fundraiser for political prisoners. And we managed to hook up a bunch of these guys with families and everything like that with about like £1,000 each just to try and help them out a bit. But I was in there basically collecting their details.
Do you have any idea how many political prisoners the UK has at the moment?
I have no idea. No. I mean, I was able to get the contact details, obviously, those who came through my wing, but I presume they got spread amongst the prison. But I think...
But I mean, that's one wing, one prison, one part of the country.
Yeah, yeah.
And given the number of arrests for speech and social media posts, there must be thousands and thousands of political prisoners spread across the system.
Yeah, and the hardest part is actually making contact with them, because you've got things like I think it's called findaprisoner.com or something like that, but it takes weeks to months to actually get a return from them to make contact, at which point some of them might even be out.
But they are spread out enough that it's not like the Albanians. You can't form your own gang.
No. And there is no... like the Albanians had a kind of like prison gang. They kept them themselves, and then really the whites, you'd have like the gypsies, kind of like travellers or whatever. Right. But and you know, half of them would be related, like the ones I was on in Hull. Like they'd have people coming in fresh and be like, "Oh, my cousin, you know, Jono, meet Jono."
It's a family meetup.
Yeah. So it's like you'd have people, and they've got. I think their respect hierarchy works on age. So you'd have people, it's like, you know, they'd be a year older, and it's like, you've got to listen to me and do whatever I say you've got to do. But
in low IQ society, that's probably the best metric that you can apply.
Yeah. But they were sound, you know,
You didn't have any sticks about gypsies then?
No, I didn't actually. I suppose that's probably one topic. Maybe I did.
You need another one.
yeah, screw gypsies. I'm back inside. but I got along really well with them.
So does it factionalise in there quite quickly? Except the whites don't tend to have a faction, or do they just form their own?
The whites don't tend to have a faction, and it's not like you're seeing faction on faction violence. it's more just people stick to their own with whatever language they're speaking.
So it's not quite like the American films that we see.
No. That's what I was expecting going in. Was The Shawshank Redemption, was, you know, any number of TV series or anything like that, where it's like I was going to get inducted into the Aryan Brotherhood as soon as I arrived. Turns out we don't have that in UK prisons.
Couldn't start one then.
Yeah, I tried. it really wasn't necessary.
And this order system that emerged within it, is that because there would be like a slightly more intelligent criminal who's been there, you know, somebody who's got an 105 IQ who's been in there for a while, and he would become like the wing boss or something? Is that how it works?
It's mainly drugs. Dictated, whoever's dealing is going to be kind of controlling tacitly everyone who's taking from him. And that would allow him to gain, you know, I mean, for the most things, it's paltry. You'd have your drug dealer would have, say, his little table in his cell. He'd have a bunch of shower gels, unopened, untouched, but very neatly arrayed. And that was basically just him flexing with, you know, we can't have Lamborghinis, so instead I'm going to have, look at all my shower gels that people have
fantastic.
Given me to get in my good books or whatever.
It must have filled you with awe the moment you saw that.
Oh, yeah, it's bizarre. Like, you walk into some cells and they'd be perfectly orderly with all these kind of like...
So where does that leave you if you're not on drugs and you're not ethnic? What, you just sort of float along, do you?
Yeah, you can operate outside the system. For the most part, I'm quite a friendly, kind of gregarious guy, so I'd get along with people. And I ended up falling in with these kind of soft power hierarchies purely because I was friendly and polite, and I wasn't, you know, fiending and trying to get stuff off them. I was just like, all right, man, how are you doing? They're like, all right.
And so if I ever have to go to jail for a podcast that I make, which could well happen, let's face it. I mean, it could, if you can go to jail for what you did, I mean, presumably I can go to jail for saying the same thing.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for that door to go.
So as long as I stay off drugs and I'm not too snarky, which will be a challenge, I'll probably be all right then.
Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously it depends which prison you go into. I think the ones down south are a lot rougher. But
really?
up north, yeah, because, I mean, they're a lot more ethnically diverse down south, so the prisons are you know, like, if you look at footage on, say, a news thing on the prisons down south, it seems almost entirely black, whereas Hull prison,
right,
entirely white. You could probably count the black inmates on one hand. I think it varies greatly. And there was a guy who went in, his name skips my mind at the moment, but he went into, I think, was it Sheffield jail? And he ended up killing himself, and he was in from the Southport kind of unrest.
Mm.
And I've heard Sheffield jail is pretty heavily kind of Pakistani, Asian, Muslim, whatever.
Right.
So it's like, what pressures did he face that I didn't? And did he feel very much alone? Whereas I felt, you know, like the other prisoners I talked to, they're just as disgusted at the demographic replacement, despite being heroin dealers. They still see an issue with us being replaced.
I mean, when your moral order is being looked down on by heroin dealers.
Yeah.
You've got a problem. So we also talk about the real criminals as well. The people who work for the state, because weren't you subjected to struggle sessions within there?
Yeah, because despite not being actually charged with a terrorism offence, my public order offence was described as terrorism adjacent, which allowed me to be covered by the National Security Division upon release. So I got a probation officer from the National Security Division.
But the adjacent bit being that they used it as an excuse to investigate you, but that holds up as a reason to punish you further in jail.
Yeah, and basically it's like you were putting out these stickers. Clearly the only conclusion to that is eventually you will engage in violent terrorism. You know, which is
okay.
Nonsense. But it's such as their
highly tenuous logic, but okay.
But while in prison, I had TACT designation, which is someone who's in prison for something under the Terrorism Act. You have TACT designation.
TACT, what does that sound for? Like terrorism?
Terrorism Act.
Oh, Terrorism Act.
Yeah. But it's like, so I was being treated as a terrorism prisoner despite not actually having been charged with terrorism.
But presumably that means you sit down with somebody who actually knows something about terrorism and is then having to wedge this into stickers.
Yeah, and this was the confusing thing, because I had the probation guy and he was just complete boomer shit lib, completely opposed to me.
So he's effectively the political officer. He's the commissar in the jail.
Yeah. No, he was once I'd released from jail. During jail, they didn't have anyone. You know, there was just do your time. once I was out on probation, that's when they have all these restrictions on you. So I couldn't talk to any of my friends.
So you weren't doing struggle sessions in jail then? You weren't sat down with a probation officer or any sort of political officer to try and change your thinking?
I think you
got left alone while you were in jail?
Yeah, I think I had one meeting right at the start with a female probation officer, but it was just, what do you mean black people can't be British? And I'm like, well, I understand British as ethnicity. Mm. And it's like, by definition, they can't be ethnically British. They can be, passport British, but they can't be ethnically British. And they're just, that would just fly completely over the head. Like, what do you even mean? when I'd say,
I did a segment not so long ago when it looked like they were ramping up the Ukraine war to the point where they were actually going to start conscriptions. And a whole bunch of black content creators went around interviewing black kids in the street saying, would you be happy to be conscripted to fight in Ukraine? And pretty much every single one of them said, no, this isn't my country. I'm not British.
Exactly. British. Yeah. British when it comes to claiming benefits. But
yes.
Like, whoa, fight for the country. Yeah, yeah, right,
not that, obviously. so you get out, and then what happens once you're out? Is that when the political commissars
come
in? That's
when it all starts, yeah, because they've got you on license at that point, and they can do with you what they want. And I think I had about 30 or so license conditions, but no internet, can't talk to anyone.
How does that work in a household where there's more than one person?
Well, this is the thing, because they said, you can't talk to anyone in PA. And I said, but my wife is the deputy leader. And they're like, we're giving you a carve out for your wife. And I was like, okay.
Well, what if somebody comes to the house to meet her?
Well, so it's like, we're not going to be there, but you'd have to leave the house. And I was like, okay, I will definitely leave the house. we'd have people around or whatever,
It was your bloody house. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And my wife's the deputy leader, so I'm going to be aware of the goings on within the organization and things like that. I didn't attend any of the official events where I might be in pictures. However, I still spoke to people and things like that.
You say 30 conditions. So that was one. But, what kind of stuff goes into these conditions?
They had one where if I start any new relationship, I have to inform counterterrorism. And you might think it's like, oh, but you're married. If I go to the playground and start talking to one of the dads there and we go, oh, we should have a play date with the kids. I have to inform counterterrorism of his name and date of birth, which obviously makes for an uncomfortable first conversation with someone when you ask for those kind of things.
You could avoid that to an extent by being aloof, but what if somebody just comes over and starts talking to you? You have to sort of edge away, or you eventually have to have the conversation with them. If you continue this friendly chat in a playground, I'm going to need to put counterterrorism police on you.
Yeah. So it's like, generally, I just wouldn't tell them if I had one of these friendly chats, whether they're at the play gym or whatever. Just wouldn't tell them. I'd have friends, like people who weren't involved politically, like old school friends, they'd be like, oh, can I talk to you? And I'd be like, it's like, if you call this number, my phone number, they will see the number and demand that I provide name and date of birth for you. So it's like, if you want to talk to me, you can call Laura, and she'll pass the phone to me. But it's like, Christ. No one wants to give their details to counterterrorism because they're like, I don't know what you're going to do with it. I don't know if I posted something on Facebook 5 years ago that you're going to pull me up on, So it really isolated me for the time that I was out.
And the idea being what you were, your sentence was 2 years and you served 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the time that you served was partly because I don't think many people knew who you were when you went in? Afterwards, I could just say your name and people instantly knew who I was talking about. So do you think your profile being raised while you were in was a factor in serving less time?
No, it's the 40% thing. So Starmer prison overcrowding, he made everyone do 40% if it wasn't for like violent crime or terrorism. Mm. And I thought, am I going to get it? And thankfully I did, because it got me out on the 17th of December. So I was there just in time for Christmas.
Is this also why you didn't launch any appeals? Because the process would have basically meant you stayed in longer.
The process wouldn't have even gone through. Like, it takes so long for an appeal that by the time...
And you would have been sat in jail that whole time if you'd launched an appeal.
Oh, no, you would have been still been released, but I presume it would have just... I don't know if the appeal would have carried on, or if they take the paperwork and go like, he's out now, drop it, or what. But it's like, there would have been no point appealing it while inside, because you're looking at a year to turn around, and I was like, well, I'm going to be out in a year. So it's like...
So they kind of lock you into the guilty trial, the guilty verdict.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, and also when you go through an appeal process, you have to show some sort of mistrial. And it's like, right, clearly they're taking great pains to do everything by the book, and you can't appeal because you don't like the way the jury went. You know, I'd have to show some sort of, like, they introduced evidence that didn't exist or something like that, and they hadn't done any of that. So, or it's like it's a disproportionate sentence. Mm. However, you know, the sentence falls within the sentencing guidelines. So he hasn't gone like, you know, you're doing 10 years when really the maximum. Okay.
And then when it goes the other way, when you've got Labour councillors saying, go and slit their throats, he doesn't appeal because he's quite happy with it. So from the system's point of view, well, that guy, we simply didn't do anything. And this guy, well, we followed our own procedures and therefore it's all fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So yes, you're out and what happens with these struggle sessions? Cause you talk about it quite a lot in the book, and it was just so extraordinary that.
Yeah. Cause with a probation guy arguing with him, I mean, for one, there's a power dynamic. He's in complete control and I can't.
I bet he loved that.
Loved it. You could tell that he was just really reveling in arguing with me and just having me just have to stay planted.
There is a certain type of personality who, in no natural system, would they ever have any power over anybody else. Mm. The spiteful mutant type.
Mm.
Give them a position where they've got a little bit of power. And it's a quaint example compared to what you experienced, but I noticed this over the COVID period. All of a sudden, little Karens popped up all over the place and they were reveling in being able to go around and tell people off.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's that kind of, and presumably this guy was one of those.
Oh, I bet he loved the COVID period, yeah. Probably true. Right. Probably triple mastered.
So he's an out and out ideological enemy, is he? And he has complete power over you for what, an hour a week or something?
Usually about 2 hours.
2 hours a week.
Yeah. I mean, I think he introduced himself via email while I was in prison.
Yeah.
You
get emails in prison?
You can email a prisoner. And so the probation service would use that to get in contact.
Well, do they sit you down in front of a PC every so often, or do they print it out or something when you're inside?
They print it out and then they deliver it along with regular mail.
Oh, I see.
With a little reply sheet or anything. But actually, my first interaction with him was they just took me down to the interview rooms and he shook my hand and said, it's like, oh, I'm your probation officer. I'm not like your regular probation officers. And I was like, oh, right. Is he implying that he's, a little bit right wing or something like that? And it's like, and that proceeded with 90 minutes of just absolute, like, vitriolic back and forth between the two of us on politics and race and immigration and all this kind of
stuff. So hang on, he's got a job where a shit lib basically just gets to tell off people for not agreeing with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And unlike shit libs on YouTube who we just don't watch.
Mm.
You have to engage.
Yeah. Because once I was out, I'd tried different tactics. I'd be like, right, I'm just going to agree with him on everything, you know, to shut him down, you know, just to take the piss, really. And he'd be like, no, this is malicious compliance. And if you continue, I'll send you back. And I was like, right, okay.
So you can't agree with him and you can't disagree with him?
No. So then I'll just disengage. And anything he brings up, I'll just be like, and just give him nothing. And he'd be like, no, this again is, you're not engaging. One of your restrictions is you have to engage with the probation service. So you not answering my questions or just not giving me, you know, more than one word answers, you're not obeying your restrictions. You'll go back inside for the 14 months.
So you were being threatened with an additional 14 months jail if you didn't have a struggle session, if you didn't argue with a shitlib.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the end, it just became, I would not disassociate, but try not to get too emotionally invested in the argument we're having. The arguments he was presenting were just, it was either bad faith argumentation, kind of tactical nihilism, where it's like, you know, we'd be talking about, he didn't believe that white people or British people had a homeland here in England, Wales, Scotland, whatever. And I'd be like, it's like, oh, okay, well, what about Indians? You know, are they indigenous to India? And he'd be like, nope. I'd be like, Maori to New Zealand? Nope. Japanese to Japan? Nope. And I was like, so you don't believe there's any indigenous people on Earth? And he's like, nope. And I was like, so you also don't see a problem with, you know, you could just have someone move in somewhere and just wipe them out because they're not indigenous. They've got no right to that land. You can just take it. And he'd be like, nope. And it's like, I know you don't believe this. It's like, why are you saying this?
It's not even internally consistent.
No, it's not. It's mad.
Because by the first part of his statement, he's just justified the British Raj.
Yeah.
Well, and also the
the conquest of the sort of Native Americans of America.
Yeah, and he'd previously said he was like pro-Palestinian and didn't agree with what Israel was doing. I'd be like, well, I mean, what right do the Palestinians have to oppose it? Israel can just go in there and just take the land. You know, no one's got a homeland. You know, you can just take things. You know, it's like, it's like I say, it's completely inconsistent. But this is, that was the arguments with him, where it's like, if you started to get ahead,
if you won the argument
on a point, he would then just go back to it's like, I either didn't care about it or here's some nonsense. And then you can't argue with the nonsense. So it's like, a lot of the times I'd be laughing at him because of the kind of the knots he's getting himself twisted.
Is there such a thing as, so it's malicious in compliance or something if you don't argue or if you agree with him?
If I agree with him,
can you laugh at him? Are you allowed to do that?
Yes.
Oh, so okay.
I did that a few times where I'd be like, come on, man, what are we doing? And he'd be like, oh.
Could you see the cogs turning in his head? I mean, did he ever do that sort of blue screen thing that liberals sometimes do where they freeze up? It's like, oh shit, he's used logic in a way that is undeniable.
It'd always be very quick to move on to stuff. So you'd know if you got a good win in that he couldn't kind of back away from, because it'd be like, anyway, enough about that. We'll just talk about this. And it's like, oh, okay, got that one. Okay, points there, you know. But it's like, you try and gaslight. Like you bring up something he said like last week, and it's like, and I know you said it because I wrote it down in that diary right after we left. So I know you said it. It's like, I didn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I was like, I know you did. And he's like, no, I wouldn't. it's like, well, I don't want to show you the books. You might take it from me. However, it's like, but I know you did. And it's like, I'm going to put it out there so everyone's going to see you.
I mean, on one hand, this kind of sounds, if you could do it once or twice just for fun, I think I'd do that. I think I'd have an argument with this guy.
Mm. Yeah, because it's, I mean, we do it on Twitter, Facebook and everything. Yeah. You know, you'll delve in and exchange a couple of blows and go like, oh, owned him. You know, good. But then it's like when that argument, when your freedom rests upon it, all of a sudden it becomes a bit grim. And when you've been doing it weekly for 14 months, and then on top of that, you've got your weekly prevent meetings and counterterrorism meetings, it's like it all just becomes a bit tiring.
So you were doing this struggle session, but what were the other ones you mentioned, prevent and counterterrorism?
Yes.
So how many meetings a week were you attending?
Minimum three, occasionally more, because I also stayed at a hostel for 7 months. So I'd have a weekly meeting with my key worker as well, where we'd just look at each other and she'd go, it's like, do you need any help with drugs or alcohol issues? And I'd be like, no. And she'd be like, okay, we haven't got any issues with you.
So how many of those meetings do you do?
Those are weekly as well.
For how long?
Normally most people, go into a hostel for maximum 2 months before they get you out into the general public. For me, because I was being handled by the National Security Division, they were allowed up to 12 months. So I stayed in the hostel for 7 months before I was allowed to return home and actually.
So they would have known, and the jail would have known as well, that you weren't on drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, people who
the key
actually
there
were
to help you with the drugs, but the hostel is really there to acclimatize you back to civilian life. So you've got people.
You'd only been in for 10 months.
Exactly. So I was in there with people who've been away for 20 years, and they were coming out like they'd never seen a smartphone before.
Yeah.
And they were like, "It's like the screen's really dark. How do you unlock it?" And I'd be like, just flick that up. And he's like, oh, right, okay. Then like, you know, but it's like, but they'd be out in 2 months. Whereas me, you know, a guy who's only been away for 10, you know, and it's
so they really were turning every screw to inconvenience you to the maximum possible extent.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, even the return home took like a kind of 2 month period of like, right, you're going to do a few weeks where you're going to do one night at home, then a few weeks of two nights at home. And it's like, I'm spending every day at home with the kids. It's not like I'm going to be like, whoa, if I'm home past 7, I might just flip out, you know, and do crime, you know? So it's like, yeah, they denied me just being able to stay overnight, because I'd have a, from 7 p.m. till 6 a.m. curfew, and then a midday check-in where I had to arrive at the hostel, sign my name, and then I could leave again. So basically I couldn't have a day out with the kids. But at 6 a.m. I'd be out the door, back home for 6:20, be there for the kids, waking up, spend a few hours with them, check in, come back for the kids, and then go home just before they go to bed. And that continued for months. And it's just completely pointless, to where the hostel staff were like, I mean, why are you here for this long? Like, there's absolutely no reason for you to be here.
Because the state truly hates you.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do everything possible. And presumably, if, I don't know, if on your way back to the hostel,
there was something that happened, you know, a car crash or whatever it was, that they would you would then get done for not complying and turning
yeah.
up.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like there were a few times where it was touch and go. You know, I think at one time I had a blown out tire, and I arrived like three minutes to seven, and I was just like, so risky, you know.
And if you broke any of the conditions, that would be the excuse they needed. Mm.
And
to throw you
the
back in.
Severity of my crime, like for most people, say if you were caught doing drugs in the hostel, you'd go back to prison for 7 days and then you'd come back. So I'd see him leave, I'd see him come back. Whereas for the severity of my crime and the nature of my crime, if I was to go back, I'd do the full term. So it could have been up to 14 months or, you know, I mean.
They had deliberately designed a system that just through random happenstance maximized the possibility of you turning up 2 minutes late or something like that, and then they had all the excuse they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. So there was a number of times throughout the 14 months where we got really close, and I mean, one of them was eventually I was allowed a smartphone for work in like July or something like that. But I think in November I had some banking trouble, and Laura had shown me her phone with the, you know, the customer service number on for like NatWest or whoever it was, and showing it to me. And at the time, my daughter had taken my phone and had it on camera and taken a photo of me. It's my legs. And then Laura showing me the phone, and it was on my phone. And I thought, it's like in counterterrorism, every month did a digital forensic breakdown of my phone, everything, any phone call I'd made, any pictures, websites.
And again, this is extraordinary. The amount of stabbings, murders and terrorism we get in this country, and counter-terrorism police are spending, I mean, this must have been two or three people's, one of their key assignments was just working on you.
Mm. Yeah, because I'd have counter-terrorism officers show up wherever I was working, you know, whether it was Halifax, Leeds, wherever they'd pop over in the car and just be like, all right, do you want to have a chat? Half an hour, and then I'd go back to work.
I mean, an enormous amount of resources are being spent on somebody who did some stickers that were legal.
Like I say, this picture that my daughter had taken, you know, I think they were deliberating for 2 weeks whether to send me back inside over the Christmas period, you know, for the remaining 3 months of my sentence. And I was just thinking, it's like, but their excuse was, it's like, well, Laura was showing you her phone, and, you know, I mean, you could have been doing anything with that phone. You could have been calling Mark Collett, you know, you could have been doing anything, because my restrictions were, if I was to use the internet, I had to use my phone. But if I was at a bus station and I went, oh, do you have the time? And you went and looked at your phone, that would be a breach, because I've asked you to use your phone, you know. Or if I was like, oh, do you know what time the bus is? I'll just look it up. Oh, don't do that, please. You know, it's like that's the level at which, however, they're not. You know, we're not in the panopticon, so they couldn't actually know. I'd have to basically tell them if I'd done something.
I don't think
like
even
that.
The Soviets did this level of panopticon.
No. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's a modern digital era, so they're able to see everything that you're doing for the most part.
I'm even more upset by this now than I thought I was, because this is, I mean, as if the original conviction wasn't bad enough, this is just constant harassment designed in such a way as to maximize the possibility that they could send you to jail for 14 months.
Yeah, yeah. And like I say, I had that prevent officer, and he was from the Desistance and Disengagement Program, which is normally reserved for people who have actually done terrorism. And his job is to basically convince them that, you know, pipe bombing your local holy site or whatever is a bad idea. And
his whole job is to do that for actual terrorists.
Yeah, and he admitted that.
And he's busy because we keep letting out so many terrorists.
Mm, and he admitted that I'm the only person on his role who hadn't actually been done for terrorism. Everyone else he talked to was actually. So, but they'd brought him in to basically look for a kind of like, yes, he's a violent extremist assessment. However, because he actually deals with violent extremists, we'd talk about my politics and all this kind of stuff, completely honest with him. And he'd be like, you're not on a path to violent extremism. You're not engaging in it right now. You're not that bad. However, the first guy who came with that diagnosis of he's not that bad, they swapped him out because they wanted someone to actually come up with that diagnosis. So instead they got this, I think it was a mixed race guy from Birmingham, I think half Asian. And I guess they thought he might be more likely to bring that diagnosis. But again, you know, we went through all my politics and everything like that, and he found no issues. So the prevent guys were actually pretty good. And they actually shared quite a lot of information with me, including like the fact that they'd been put onto, I think there was a young boy putting out reform leaflets in his high school, and the Home Office had sent Prevent to him. The Prevent guy had come back and been like, yeah, there's nothing here. It's a legal political party. He's not talking about more extreme things. He's fine. And the Home Office is like, no, keep him on your books. We want to keep tabs on him. And it's like, right, okay, so this is the kind of state we're running in now where Nigel Farage's party is, you know, extremist. It's madness.
He's a bit of a lefty, but yeah. You know, I wouldn't call him an extreme lefty.
It's like, come on, what are we doing?
But I mean, everything you're describing is a state that has truly failed.
Hmm.
I mean, it's completely lost its way. It's arresting people and jailing people for things that they have decided are in their head, absent of any crime. And then they're using every aspect of the state to try and trip you up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's...
what you're describing is just pure spite and ideological zeal.
Yeah, because that's all that's propping this system up at this point, is ideology. Because the actual reality of it on the ground is complete failure, pain, misery, suffering. And it's like the only thing that's keeping them going is that ideology where it's like, eventually, if we can just get rid of you people pointing out at the problems, then there won't be problems.
Nobody notices.
Exactly, yeah.
And all the rapes, murders and terrorism can carry on unabated.
Yeah, and it's like, I thought it, emblematic of that was during the trial, the prosecution, because we were talking about the rape gangs and, you know, to prove that they existed, I had the testimony of some of the white girls and some of the horrendous stuff they went through. And while we were going through it, I got quite upset because you're hearing about girls raped by like 50 men, strung out on drugs and everything. And the prosecution asked, it's like, well, are you related to them? Do you know them? And I was like, oh, no. And I thought, and he was like, all right, and moved on. I thought, that's a strange question to ask. And it wasn't.
So why would you care if you don't know these people?
Well, it wasn't until his closing statement that I realized that's what he was getting at, because it just seemed completely out of my realm of understanding that you could come up with that. But during his closing statement, he said, it's like, oh, you saw him got upset. And clearly these were crocodile tears to justify his own racism, because it's like, how could someone be this emotionally caught up in someone he doesn't know or isn't related to? And I think that's emblematic of the kind of psychopathy and the next level of apathy that is required to freely engage in this system and be a part of it.
That is such a left-wing point of view.
Yeah.
They cannot imagine the idea of empathy for people that you're not directly connected to.
But at the same time, they can. Because they it's like, you know, your dinghy boat person. It really, well, it seems to be, yeah. It's like white people. They can't empathize with, you know, a brown person on the other side of the world. They'll, you know, shed tears and rend clothes and everything. But it's like for our people, for something happening on our doorstep, if it flies in the face of multiculturalism, their ideology, they just don't care.
Where's that meme of the brain scan that, you know, it's the further away from them and theirs, the more they care. It's a completely inverted worldview.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I suspect that they don't go after people like us who are basically saying the same thing, because we've got a higher profile.
Yeah.
And it would cause things to, I mean, let's say they arrested Carl or something, you know, you'd have a huge number of influential voices from the American right or something would be on it straight away. I mean, it would be a sort of across the spectrum. But I think with you, they probably thought they could get away with it, because quite often the people they go for are the people who don't have a profile. But ironically, what they've done is given you an enormous profile.
Yeah, they've kind of given themselves a bit of a black eye in prosecuting me, which I don't think they're expecting it at all. Whereas, I mean, we weren't expecting the level of support, but I don't think we'd seen many convictions like mine. It was really kind of, especially the Southport thing. We saw Lucy Letby, not Lucy Letby, God, Lucy Connolly. Not Letby.
yeah, different one.
But we saw like Lucy Connolly.
But I mean, that's another good example. She had very few followers.
Hmm.
The tweet was up for a few hours and it was deleted. It's kind of inverse. It's like the less profile you have, it's because what you've described is a system that is just overflowing with this spite towards the native population. And they're kind of looking for, maybe you don't want me to say this, but bugs that they can crush to alleviate their spite.
Mm.
And in doing so, they occasionally, you know, create a monster. Well, not a monster, but, you know, their point of view.
Yeah, and we saw on a larger scale after Southport, it's like they didn't address any of the underlying issues that brought about all this kind of public anger. Instead, they just kind of crammed the lid back on that pressure.
Oh, no, I remember Keir Starmer saying in response to those three girls who were murdered, and, I mean, we always talk about the three girls that were murdered, but, I mean... the rest of the girls in that room were horribly mutilated and have life-changing. And so it's a whole room full of young girls. And he stood up on the stage and said, it doesn't matter. Mm. It doesn't matter why you're rioting. That doesn't matter. Yeah. Those girls don't matter.
Yeah. Meanwhile, three ambulances burn. And it's,
yes.
you know, COVID
very noticeable
and,
difference.
Yeah. And I think everyone sees that kind of two-tier justice that we're talking about. It's just... Every time the state has to wield this power, it also sacrifices a bit of its legitimacy. And I think my case was a big one of those. Lucy Connolly, the Southport thing, you know, the Golders Green attacks. It's like every time they're wielding this power, they can't seem to actually address the issues that people have and instead just hit it with a hammer and expect it to go away. And it's like, no, it just pops up somewhere else, normally a lot bigger. But yeah, with my case... I think they thought, we'll take out this sticker guy. He's a bit of a no-name at the moment. But, I mean, after that first arrest back in 2021, that's when we started doing, like, megaphone demos outside, you know, migrant hotels. And because we were like, we know what they want to do. They want to silence us and scare us. And it's like, well, we're going to do the exact opposite, and we're going to be louder than ever before. And that's what's happened. And then since going away, the conversation's changed a lot.
Yes.
You know, like we're talking in the trial, having to prove rape gangs existed, come out 2 years later. Yes, they always existed. We know they are.
Oh, the narrative is slipping.
Yeah. And then it's like, yes. And now it's deport millions. And it's like, previously it's like, please. I mean, if we could just stop the incoming. And now it's like, don't worry about the incoming. They're all going, you know, and it's like, right. Okay. So things are changing massively.
Yeah.
And the state really doesn't have any opposition to it, because it's like all they can do is crush it. Because when I knew I was going to be talking with this probation team, prevent team and everything, I thought I was kind of excited, because I was like, right, I'm going to get the best arguments, you know, stuff that if I had hair would blow it back. And it's like, if anything's going to convince me, these guys are going to have the argument. And I asked them, it's like, please bring your big guns. I want whatever your best arguments are. And they've got nothing.
Yeah, they don't.
No.
There's literally nothing there.
And it's to understand that it's like, oh, right. Like, we're still having these debates and everything, but it's like, really, the debate's been won long ago. And I think mainly the reason why they still want to talk is because it burns time, you know, until the demographic clock kind of tips over that 50% mark. And at that point, nothing can really be done.
Then we're in Lebanon's situation.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, so, you know, dark futures. But it's it was good to finally talk to him, and it's like, and see, it's like, all right,
see the man behind the curtain, and realize it's just a little old man. He's not a wizard after all.
Yeah. And it's like all right, cool. So it's like, now I know I don't have to keep coming up with new and novel arguments or anything like that, because it's like none of that's going to work, because your answer is stop caring about it.
No, if anything, we've just got to simplify the arguments we already have and just keep repeating them.
Yeah, yeah.
And we win.
Yeah, and more and more people, whether it's my case, whether it's, you know, whatever happens next or whatever, it's like more and more people start to wake up to what's going on, who's doing it, and realize that it's like, oh, this can't be allowed to continue. You know, we've got to put a stop to it, because it's existential for us. You know, this is our homeland, and we've got to defend it with everything we've got.
Yes. Are you free and clear of the bullshit, or do I need to give you my date of birth after this?
I'll take that just to know. Free and clear. As of March 1st, I was completely released from everything. And no doubt they're still monitoring my social medias and see if I say anything bad at a demonstration or anything like that, so they can pull me away.
So what are you putting your energies into at the moment?
Patriotic Alternative. Still a regional organiser there. And I've been playing with the idea and talking with a few people about the possibility of launching a kind of basically forcing the government to either acknowledge or deny that we're Indigenous people, because I think that's incredibly important. And they've been kind of sidestepping the issue whenever possible. And I think a few months back, that was the kind of
I mean, the issue with that is, as soon as they acknowledge that there is such thing as an indigenous people to the British Isles, which they clearly are, all of the other Anglo countries have special protections and privileges for the native people. So it's not even a novel concept. All of the other Anglo countries have those privileges and protection, except in this one,
yeah,
because the natives are white.
Yeah, and I think that would be an important kind of foundational block to resistance, is to actually have that kind of legally proven and accepted. And like I say, it offers us protections that currently are being denied us purely because they refuse to.
But you're mainly working through PA, which is effectively a pressure group today. It's given up on the political party stuff.
Pressure group. Yeah, we tried to register as a political party, and we did a freedom of information request, and randomly the Home Office decides to contact the Electoral Commission. They say, oh, we'd like to talk to you about Patriotic Alternative. Next three emails are just like redacted JFK files, like black lines and everything. And then the next thing is like, yeah, you can't have it because the V in Alternative kind of looks like a tick, and that might trick voters, so you can't. So
it's a perfectly ordinary English letter.
Yeah, yeah. So it is slightly stylized, where one side is longer. But it's like to think that a voter is going to go, it's like the logo's a tick, I will have to put a tick. It's like, come on, what are we doing?
Yeah.
So we tried it for a while, but in the end, it's like I don't think another tiny micro party is going to be the solution. I mean, we've seen Restore like romp to 120,000 they're on members now or something like that. It's like crazy. And it's like to think that, you know, you setting up one man and a dog and being like, we'll be a party. It's like, no, there's Reform and Restore now. And it's like they're sucking the air out of the room for everyone.
Do you still think there is a political solution?
I think there could be at this general election. After this general election, I think the numbers game would just... it's not there anymore. The white vote is split between what? Labour, Conservatives, Restore, Reform, Green, Lib Dems, six kind of big parties, whereas the ethnic vote is basically Green. Yeah. So it's like...
it's coalescing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, so...
well, until they decide that actually they want their own thing.
Yeah,
They'll either take over the Greens or they just start their own thing.
And we're starting to see that. We're seeing independent councillors, and you've got things like the Workers' Party and everything, which are very clearly kind of like their thing. But it's like with the white vote being split past 2029 general election, purely on numbers alone, it's not going to be...
I think it can be turned around even after 2029. It's just that every subsequent election, the cost of what you'd have to do to fix it just goes up and up and up.
Yeah.
A bit like our debt situation. I mean, you can turn it around even now, but it's just so incredibly painful to turn it around now as opposed to 20 years ago.
I think ethnic sectarianism is our... I mean, it's already kind of upon us, but it's definitely in our future, a kind of Lebanon situation where our democracy, instead of like, what's best for Britain and you're going to choose left or right, instead it's going to be, it's like, all right, what's best for my ethnic group? Screw the rest of you.
Well, you know, I had a fascinating... you know, Faraz here, who's from Lebanon, and I had a fascinating conversation with him on this show. And the situation in Lebanon was, of course, the Muslim minority was growing more numerous, and there was frequent attacks on the Christian population, a bit like what we've got going on here in this country. And the thing that actually triggered the civil war was when a bunch of Christians pushed back, and that just opened the floodgates. And I think that the British government is very aware of that example. And the reason they come after people like you so much is because they're terrified of that moment when the native population is like, we've had enough and we're going to push back. Because then it's just out there and it's just off.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, the gravy train all of a sudden derails. And it's chaos.
I enjoyed the book, not least, well, it upset me, but I mean, the case has upset me for a while. But also, I liked it because you don't often get like a normal going into jail. So I quite like Jeffrey Archer's book. He wrote one years ago because he was a political prisoner as well, because David Blunkett didn't like him, so he went to jail. So it's always quite interesting to find out what it's like in there, because otherwise you just get the Americans. So where can people get your book, and what else are you kind of doing and up to at the moment?
So the book's available at grandmatowlers.co.uk if you'd like to.
Grandma Towlers.
Yeah, Grandma Towlers. And that's it's my wife's tea and coffee shop, all mail order tea and coffee. And I thought, as soon as we own the shop, I'll also put the book out via that. So if you want a signed copy, you can go there. And then we're also available on Amazon worldwide.
Okay. But you get less if it goes through Amazon, so it's probably
a little bit less. Yeah.
And you can also and you brought into our offices some tea and coffee. So
I've got a couple of copies of the book for your many bookshelves that you've got here as well. I'm planning on just basically taking over. So
if people want to support a bit of tea and coffee and a book,
Right. And it's sold really well, and I've been really supportive and everything. So I'm really pleased with how it's done, and thank you to everyone out there who's already bought one. And but going forward, we've got a few demonstrations planned coming up. Patriot Alternative being a community and activism group, we've got summer camp coming up.
Is that mainly geographically an area, or are you all over the country?
The summer camp, normally it's about central. I think it's the same place we had it last year, but I don't know where we had it last year because I wasn't allowed to attend. And then we've got the conference as well, but generally we've got regions up and down the countries. And if you're looking to meet people, I mean, similar to what's the Lotus Eaters kind of social club thing? What's it called?
It's not ours, but there is basket weaving.
So it's very similar to that. Right,
okay.
But,
a pub.
Yeah, and then but it's like, but we've also got the activism thing on that as well. So the banner drops, the demonstrations, and the leafleting, all that kind of stuff. But it's a really positive group. But we're working with Remigration now, with Steve Laws, with Woodlander Initiative and everything. And I think when I went away, it seemed like a very fractured scene. And it feels like I've come back and people are very aware of the dire straits we're in. And
are you more hopeful now?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Even if it's just for... if that ethnic sectarianism comes, that there's going to be more people who are actually going to be awake to what's going on and be willing to identify with others based on their British ethnicity and go, like, we need to band together.
I mean, I hope it doesn't. And the reason I do what I do is to try and stop that from happening in the first place.
Oh, it'd be great.
Because it'd be infinitely preferable to just have a political system that actually acknowledged what the people living in the country wanted.
Mm. Be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, Sam, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story. That was absolutely fantastic. Is there anything else you want to share with the audience before we leave you?
No, that's great. Thank you for having me. It's been it's been a really nice conversation. It's great to meet everyone in the office here as well.
Great. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.